This is The Loving Project, a podcast celebrating the 50th anniversary of Loving v. Virginia. In each episode, we hear from a different couple about what it's like to be in an interracial relationship 50 years after the Supreme Court struck down state laws banning marriage between people of different races.
In this episode, we hear from Eric and David, who married nearly 5 decades after that Supreme Court decision, and just a year after the court legalized same-sex marriages. Eric is Black and grew up in a Black neighborhood in Baltimore, but went to a predominantly white high school.
David grew up in a small town in Oregon before moving to Portland for college, and then Princeton, New Jersey, where he studied at Princeton Theological Seminary. The couple met in Philadelphia.
When I was in college in like 2001, I wrote a screenplay about this one married gay couple running into one of the couple's ex-boyfriend from college, and the ex-boyfriend is engaged to this other person, and the married gay couple has this like precocious 6-year-old son. I remember in the workshop in class, people were like, "What world does this take place in?" And the married couple was interracial, and I was like, "What do you mean? It's the world." And they're like, "Okay, you know that none of this is legal, right? Like, this is," but I was just like, that was the way my metronome was set. Like, everyone's gonna fall in love and get married. That's actually what it was called. Everyone's gonna fall in love and get married. My name is Eric, and I'm Black.
My name is David, and I'm white.
And we've been married since October of 2016. I'm a writer, and I call myself a stand-up comedian. I write plays, I write humor, and then I also host storytelling shows and do storytelling and various solo performances.
And I am a Presbyterian pastor, and I also am in the process of being trained as a couple and family therapist. So Eric and I first initially met, there was a panel discussion and Eric was helping do some storytelling coaching with LGBT people of faith. And Eric was really engaging and the stories were really interesting. And I decided that I kind of wanted to get to know this person who's talking about the intersection of sexuality and faith and just life experience. And so one of my congregants said to me, like, he's going to be the host of a storytelling show, a story slam called The Moth here in Philadelphia. And so you should really like go and check this out. And so we went, and I had been invited to be on another panel with Eric about LGBT people of faith. And I wasn't sure if I was going to do it or not. And as we were sitting there at the story slam, I sort of leaned over to the congregant, our friend Colton, and was like, you know, I have this chance to spend some more time with this guy and get to know him. Like, should I do it? And he's like, oh, you absolutely should. You guys should become friends and fall in love and get married. And I was like, no, he's way too famous for me. There's no way that that's going to happen, but I'll do that. And so I had this list of questions that they were going to ask, and they weren't necessarily the best questions, but I figured out how to create a story for each one that I could tell. Mm-hmm. And so I showed up at the event and had all these stories to tell. And Eric and I kind of, the whole conversation became us.
Yeah. It was very clear soon after we started the panel that like David and I had a really good rapport. And so at a certain point, it was just me and him talking. Like, and I was like asking him questions. I was like, let me tell you about this story about my dad. What do you think? Sort of using him as like a sounding board slash therapist slash like whatever. But we were connecting. And so after the panel, I mustered up some courage and I went over and introduced myself. And I was like, we had a great connection. And I said, I'm terrible. I have terrible game. And so I was like, oh, I'd like to go to your church sometime, which is not a thing you say to a pastor that you would like to date. Because if I show up at his church, I'm a congregant and I'm no longer, I didn't know that.
Right. And so Eric asked me about like, I've always wanted to go to your church. And I was
which
like,
which is true. That wasn't a game.
Right.
Sundays are hard for me.
Yeah. And so I was like, oh, okay, he's interested in the worshiping community. So I gave him my work email, yeah, which is like the last thing if you're trying to ask someone out on a date that you want to receive. Like,
right. Yeah,
you know, like Reverend Norse, like, here's that email, like, enjoy.
And like that email on the paper sat beside my bed until you moved in. Mm-hmm. Like, because I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I can't send selfies to, you know, David at broadstreetministry.org. That's going to be weird. But that night I went home and I was sitting on my front steps, the steps that are now our front steps. And we have this big, big tree out in front of the house. And I was sitting on my front steps and I was looking up at the sky through the branches of the tree. And this is 100% true. And I thought to myself, out of nowhere, I was like, oh, I'm going to marry that guy. And I was like, cool. And then I started thinking about how when we got engaged, I would change my profile picture on Facebook to Whitney Houston and the Preacher's Wife. Because that's really my main priority. It's like, how will I market this?
And what Whitney Houston reference can we make?
Exactly. But it just came into my head sort of clear as day, like, oh, I'm going to marry that guy. So, of course, I didn't speak to him for 2 months.
Yeah. And like, so we didn't see each other around. And the same person, Colton, was like, Eric has this one-man show. We should really go. And so I went. And the entire show is Eric talking about being single and being at your brother's wedding and figuring out being gay and Christian and what does God think and how do you relate with your family and all these things. What I didn't realize is that it was an entire show designed to like
get a boyfriend.
Yeah. Like, and like bring in your husband. And it worked in a really funny way. Mm. So we, you know, I go to this play and like, I'm making eye contact with Eric, but I'm like, well, he's a really good performer. He, you know, we're making eye contact. It's going well. And then afterwards, I was so incredibly awkward. Like, I was, like, starstruck, I guess. And Eric came up, and we were talking, and I was wearing this blue shirt with, like, white polka dots. And you came up, and you were like, oh, that shirt is so becoming on you.
Which took so much effort. I was like, this is a real gambit. This is a risk. But
And I loved it, and I thought it was so sweet. And so then I, of course, what I did was the really logical thing, which was run away. I very quickly find some reason to not be there. And so I left to go with one of my best friends up to Maine. And while I'm there, I get this Facebook message that's like 4 sentences long. And I'm like, oh, he just like very quickly wrote out this little Facebook message.
No, it took, I assembled my team and I was like, I need to ask this guy out. He came to my show. And this is the second time I produced the show myself, the second time, because the first time I did it, I didn't get a boyfriend out of it. And I was like, well, this is a waste of time. Like, why am I putting art into the universe if it's not going to bring me the thing I want, which is fame and a boyfriend? And the whole show, you know, it's called Always the Bridesmaid. And so it's like, me talking about the experience of going to my brother's wedding. Both of my brothers are black men who are married to white women. And it's me making jokes about the intersection of cultures and then me talking about this difficulty of finding a spiritual home. Apparently, it was David Catnip. I had no idea. but he was just there in the audience and I was so distracted by him, but also like really good because I'm a professional. And so I assembled a team and I was like, what do I write to David to get him to go out on a date with me? And so like literally, I think it said like, thank you for coming to the show. It was great to see you. Would you like to grab dinner sometime? And it took like probably an hour and a half to write.
Yeah, there was a slide. I didn't get a chance to ask you at the performance. Would you like to get dinner sometime?
Just the words, that's the truth. And that brings me so much anxiety. It brings it all back. I was so anxious about this. Writing a show about being like perpetually single doesn't come out of nowhere. Like I was really used to a lot of guys being like, you're great. No, thank you.
So it was so funny because the way that he wrote it too was like, I'd really like to catch dinner sometime. And so I had known that he had given me, you know, he had asked about being a congregant. So it was like, oh, maybe he wants to talk. Like, is this a date or is this like a work event? And so I'm up in Maine with my best friend Carson and we're like, reading these 4 lines over and over again, trying to figure out like, well, is it a date? And Carson and I are like, okay, well, I'll ask him where we should eat because that's going to tell me a lot. Certain cuisines are date cuisines and certain ones are not. And so I can remember you saying like, oh, we could go to Little Nona's because they have really great Italian food and I haven't been there yet. And I was like, okay, Italian is this guy like wants to like fall in love and adopt kids.
Which is hilarious because I am always looking for the highest carb count. Like I'm just hungry. Yeah. I'm always hungry. I don't care where I go. I would have a Lady in the Tramp style dinner with literally anybody.
But for me, I'm like, okay, this is Italian. This is a date. And so I'm trying to figure out like, okay, well, like, again, I've got to do some prep work here because we're going to be together and I want him to know that I'm interested in him in like boyfriend world, but also like I'm interested in knowing who Eric is, not the public persona of Eric. And as a pastor, like I have a public role and the public role is different from like the personal role. So I was really interested how Eric figured that out. And so I came in with a plan. Like we had this whole conversation about public and private. The restaurant reminds me a lot of my great aunt Lorraine and my great uncle Buzz, who have both passed away, but like of their home. We were talking about that and the people we wanted in a home in the future. And like, it was this, we were like conjuring our life in that restaurant for 3 hours with a waitress who like could not care less.
She didn't even offer us dessert, which is infuriating to me. No, it's true. It was the most unexpected and sort of miraculous of dates. And the entire time I had this sort of low level anxiety that it was going to turn out to be not a date. And like you said, like we were, it was like an overture for a musical. You sort of heard all of the things that we had hoped to hear, and that had never happened. We were really united around stories and storytelling. We were really united around like food and comfortable food spaces and family, as well as like sort of wrestling with difference and conflicting cultures, you know. David's from the West Coast and I'm from the East Coast. It was also really important for me to find out if I was the first Black person that David had been on a date with, or whether I was like part of a long line of Black dudes, you know. And like, I wasn't either. And I was like, great, this is wonderful. Like, this isn't a fetish and this isn't an experiment. So the date lasted 3-4 hours. We finally got kicked out of the restaurant. So we just started walking on the way to his apartment. And I didn't have a plan. I was like, I'm going to walk him home, but I don't want to walk him home too far because I don't want him to think that I'm trying to go home with him. Like, this feels very sort of like, this is the end of the date, but I don't want it to end. So I'm like having a meltdown as usual.
And so we like have this moment where we're like, okay, well, we need to part ways. And Eric turns to me and says, like, I had a really good time. And I wanted to make sure that he knew that when I said, like, I had a really great time too, that was actually true. That wasn't just like, okay, let me say these things so that I can, you know, say goodbye and never see this person again and be really awkward when we run into each other in a tavern. Like, that was not the world I wanted to have happen. And so I just like as emphatically as possible, like making sure I was like making full eye contact. I think maybe we held hands there, but there was this like connection where I was like, I had a really great time too. I would really like to do this again.
And it like burst through this haze, you know. It was kind of amazing. I heard his intention so clearly, which is amazing because I'm just a fortress of misunderstood intentions and and anxiety. And so like I can misread anything. And so, but it was very clear that he wanted to hang out again. And that was wonderful. And so we went on 3 more dates that week because we're nothing if not completists. And yeah, by the end of the week, we were done.
Yeah, it was pretty clear. I mean, we like, Eric had an opening at a theater that he was working at the time. And we went to that and hung out late at night, and I got to meet your friends, and that was a really wonderful experience. And then I was living at a church and in the middle of Center City, and we have a roof that you can climb up to. And so I like showed Eric the sanctuary, and I was like, well, that's a really weird thing to do on a date, is like, let me show you this church.
Oh yeah, I definitely thought he was gonna kill me. But I was okay with it. I was totally okay.
You thought I was gonna like hide you under the pews.
Oh yeah, he brought me into this huge sanctuary, like huge, like Da Vinci Code style sanctuary. And it's pitch black, and he has to like fumble around in the dark to look for the fuse box. And so I'm in this darkened sanctuary, and I was like, well, that's a situation that I don't find myself on many gay dates. And and then he hits the lights, and it's gorgeous, and it's beautiful. And it's, you know, all these old pews and dome ceiling. And he's walking around telling me the history of the space. David's the best tour guide in the entire world. He knows everything about everything. He remembers everything. And I don't remember anything, mostly because most of the time, when people are talking to me, I'm thinking about the way that I will probably die. And so I'm looking at these pews. I'm like, I'll probably pull those wood boards there and stuff my body under there. And I was totally okay with it. This is very weird.
And so then we ended up going onto the roof just to like see the city lit up and like see the sky. And so we're like on this precarious roof with like 4 stories to drop, at which point Eric apparently felt totally comfortable
Yeah, I was fine.
I could just easily off him. And like, so I'm terrified of heights.
Right. So you're thinking about killing me. So
I'm thinking about how I'm going to kiss you and then I'm going to plunge to my death. And that's the end. And I'll be like, oh, I was so close.
What a fantastic third date.
I'd be so angry with God. I'd be like, look, that's just cruel. But then our last date was the Harry Potter Festival came up in Chestnut Hill. And I was like, oh my gosh, do you like Harry Potter? We should totally go. And I like, in my mind, if you're going to the Harry Potter Festival, you have to dress up. And like, that was maybe one of those things that you should communicate to the person that you're going on a fourth date with. So we like meet up to get on the train, the regional rail, which is the Hogwarts Express. And there's different actors and people that are already on the train and like a bunch of school children. And Eric walks up and I'm in like full robe. I've got a wand. I've got like my Gryffindor scarf on. And I think you were not expecting any of that.
No. And like what's interesting is like you look like Harry Potter. And I was... You like you know, if you haven't seen him, he has glasses and he is a white person with brown hair. And that's really all I need for Harry Potter. Like,
I'll take it.
And so you come rolling through the station, giddy, dressed as Harry Potter. And then, like, I'm wearing, like, a hoodie. And I felt very much like a weird adult in a space that I should have felt like a youthful, magical being. But I also felt like I had permission to like go on an adventure. And it was so much fun. And we rode the train back together. And there was this woman behind us on the train, a black woman. And we were like, by that time, we were all cuddled up. And we were like holding hands and kissing on the train, which I don't do. I get very nervous about people being unkind. And she started talking to us. She just wanted to know like how long we'd been dating. And we were like, 3 days. And she was just really sweet. And, you know, after that, I think we started settled into like a more regular dating schedule. I really don't remember the first time I thought about me. I mean, I was on the front steps. But like, I think the first thing I remember is you saying, I know how I want to ask you to marry me. Mm-hmm. And it was like 3 months in. And that was not a terrifying thought.
Well, and we had sort of like we started dating in October, and then at Thanksgiving, my dad was coming into town, and mm-hmm. so he was going to meet Eric. Mm-hmm. So that was like a month in, yeah. And so I mean, clearly, I was thinking about like, oh, well, my father should meet mm-hmm. Eric before you know we get engaged, which is crazy. And then and then that happened, and then December at Christmas, my mom came into town, mm-hmm. and so Eric met my mother. It was pretty quick.
We're barreling through, yeah, but we didn't actually get engaged. I knew that. You know, it was important for David to meet my family. Mm-hmm. And I have one brother and sister-in-law who live in South Carolina. So it just wasn't feasible for them to meet. But my youngest brother was getting married in May. And so I was like, well, great. I'll invite you to the wedding and you can meet everybody at the wedding. And then we're allowed to get engaged. But by that time, I don't know, by May, we were like, we're engaged. Yeah. So we were just openly talking about it for a while, but we got engaged in July.
Yeah, we dated for 9 months and then we're engaged for 14 months. Mm-hmm. Yeah. As a Presbyterian pastor, it was really important for me, and just as a lifelong Presbyterian, it was really important that I was able to get married in my church. And so the Presbyterian Church had approved marriage equality before the Supreme Court ruling. But the ruling said in the Presbyterian Church, we said that you could be married in any state where it was legal. The Supreme Court ruling for me opened up as a pastor what I knew to be true, that God blessed all unions and that that was possible. And so for a lot of people, it was the celebration of a legal victory. And for me, it was this victory of God's love in the world. And so when we got engaged, there was just so much that felt true and possible and just this incredible victory of love in a way that was incredibly profound for me.
Legalization of marriage in Pennsylvania had, I think, a much greater impact on me. It was like a sudden shift. It was like a light went on in a room that I didn't realize was dark. Sort of like when you're sitting in a space and like it's getting close to evening and you look around, you're like, oh my gosh, it's actually darker in here than I thought. And you turn on the light and you're like, oh, I feel better. I didn't realize how uncomfortable I had been. I didn't realize how all of the things that I was primed to believe about myself, that I was worthy of love and marriage and family, were constantly being denied. So to have that affirmed, that I could conceivably get married, was amazing. But the nationwide victory sort of felt like this interesting afterthought, I think because I'd just been living with it in Pennsylvania for so long. By that time, I was sort of like, oh, I own this. I own this idea. This idea is in my genetic makeup. It's in my bones. And like, there's nothing that can shake it. But I don't care what the Supreme Court does anymore in terms of marriage, because we're on the other side of a mountain and it's in me. And once that change was made internally, it sort of became irrelevant what the government thought. I've started reflecting a lot more on like the experiences that my parents had growing up. They would give me advice about how to move through the world as a Black person and what kind of people to be careful of. There were times where I thought, well, these people are crazy. Like, they have antiquated ideas about race. And I used to hope that our children wouldn't think that we were crazy. You know, they would think that we had a really good sense of what the world was like. Now I hope that they do, because that means the time has moved as quickly as it has for my parents. My parents are in their 60s. So like the Loving versus Virginia ruling was within their lifetime. They were like teenagers. And that's stunning to me. There are times that I feel really sad, because I like to believe, we all like to believe, I think, that like time is just moving so quickly and we're so much further than we were, and life is so different. But it also is sort of reassuring, because there are moments, you know, even in our relationship, where one of us is perceiving something to be very different than the other person. And it's nice to have a reassurance that like we're not crazy, that the world is actually a little bit slower and a little bit dumber, but I guess still trudging. 50 years is not a long time.
No. And I think for my family, my mom recently was in the car with me. We were talking about car insurance, and I took my car insurance card and I keep it on my dash under a little pillow so that it doesn't slide around. And she was like, "That's really weird. Why do you do that?" And I was like, "Well, I'm married to a Black man, and I'm terrified of being pulled over and going to the glove compartment. And because my husband's Black, a police officer perceiving that there's a gun there. And so I keep the registration and the insurance on the dash." And my mom, you know, sort of looked at me and said, like, "That's still a problem here, you know, like, like in Pennsylvania or like in Baltimore when you're there." And I'm sort of looking at her like, "Are you looking at what's happening in the world?" But for her, there have been these moments with my family where I think that, you know, it's like, "Oh, cool. Like, that decision happened," or like, "Marriage equality. Great. Like, cool. Check the box. We're good. Like, my children are safe." You know, my mom talks about, you know, she now has two sons and what a beautiful gift of this expanding family. And then there's these sort of moments where she's like, "Oh my gosh, like the world is different than how I've thought it is." And so I think for me, you know, thinking about it's been 50 years, I think for my family, it happened like yesterday.
Our marriage is specific and unique and will never be recreated. And like, my brothers and I don't really talk about being married to white people, because we're living in very different spaces, you know? There every once in a while we're like, "These white people are crazy." but not really, because they're, you know, each spouse is white crazy in a different way.
We all have our own white nonsense.
Right, we all have our own Black nonsense. And it's just nonsense, and it's not even. And like, you know, my brother's spouses are delightful people. But yeah, the idea is that we are these constellations as opposed to these planets. I think that's much more comfortable. I like to look at your star system as opposed to the gravitational pull of like your skin.
And what I love is that your family has been so wonderful about showing me the constellation. Mm-hmm. Like the first time I met Eric's parents, I was in Baltimore for a conference and we went over on Valentine's Day. Mm-hmm. And his parents met me at the door and welcomed me into the home. And your mom walked me through the family story and the ancestors with photographs and paintings. And there was this really beautiful moment. We walked into the house and like your mom and dad in their dining room, there's the dining room table. And on one side of the dining room table, it's the family tree, and there are two photographs of slave cabins where the family traces history back to. But on the other side is this beautiful painting that Eric had commissioned of one family member who was conceived in slavery but born in freedom. Mm-hmm. And they're on either side of the table, which is this like beautiful narrative of liberation and of transformation. But she walked me through the house and like I saw all the photographs and she told me the stories, and then we got to sit down at the table. And it was, this is the constellation. Mm-hmm. This is who we are. And here's Eric as a child. And here are the brothers. And like, it was so wonderful and so beautiful and just such incredible hospitality. But also like, let me tell you about this person that you're in love with. Let me tell you even more about his constellation.
Yeah. Yeah. there was a point, I don't remember when this was, but there was a Black Lives Matter protest. Mm-hmm.
The Ferguson ruling.
The Ferguson, yes. And David went in his collar. And I didn't think that that was, for various reasons, I didn't think that that was going to be a helpful experience for me. And so I didn't go. And I think up until that point, you know, we were sort of just two people coming together. And then like sort of around that time, I became sort of very starkly aware that there were these larger conversations that people were having to have and that I didn't want to have inside of my relationship. And so I became very careful around talking about privilege and talking about access. And there would be times that like David's intentions were wonderful, that I would still be completely uninterested in having an educational conversation or completely uninterested in saying like, I experienced this in a different way. And also one of the things that I think was hardest for me was being in such close proximity to a white person who wants to be a part of a better world and having to sort of watch them struggle. So yeah, I think there were never moments where I was like, oh, this guy is crazy. But there were definitely moments where I was like, oh, this is a white person, which, you know, duh. But I don't know. I think there is a part of me that thought we love each other and that's all that matters. And that's just, that's naive and that's not true. And when we talk about having kids, we were talking, you know, there's so many things around having kids and language. I'm very careful about language. And if we end up, you know, adopting a child who's Black, there's a lot of things that I want to be really, really specific about in terms of like normalizing experiences and centering their experience as normal and not other, because otherness has been the sort of prevailing feeling of my entire life. And so like, I'm not interested in having a kid feel like he's othered in his own house. I randomly, you know, I will just throw things at David. And like one day I was like, I don't want to teach our child about slavery until he's a teenager. And he's like, well, I think he might hear a rumor or something. and I'm like, all right, well, we'll see. But the impetus was that I'm constantly trying to locate the spaces of otherness in my brain and to root them out and prevent them for a kid. But, you know, they're like, you know, there's those weird cultural things where I talk about like, we're talking about hair, I think, mm-hmm. at one point. And I was like, we probably have very different barbershop experiences. Even the process of like getting a first haircut for a white child is very different from a Black child. Like both my brothers sobbed through our first haircuts because it's terrifying. There's a razor in your ear and this guy's like ripping a pick through your hair and it's like really unpleasant. And that's normal for me, you know? And that's a thing with us. I think we walk blithely into these conversations and then you look around and you're like, all right, so Black people's hair hurts. And so this is weird. This is a space where I have some sensitivity and some damage. And like the thing you said before, it's not you, it's me, but also it's the world. And anyway, we should stop talking about this because I think I hate white people. I think I hate white people today. And so like one of the things that's so great about David is that I do talk about how much I hate white people a lot. And you always take that in stride. And I feel bad. But I also like there are times where I'm like, I am not pleased.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, that's not I don't, you know, why am I saying this on a podcast? Now all the white people I know are going to be like, do you hate me? And I'll be like, well, a little bit. but not really. You understand right. When I say that. But that's got to be hard to hear.
Well, it's interesting though, because it's not hard for me to hear, because I feel for me, like being Presbyterian, like our view of humanity mm-hmm. is not great. Mm-hmm. Like people are not particularly wonderful. Mm-hmm. Like we have the ability to learn grace and we have the ability to be transformed. But like our natural state, like in my tradition, is like people are kind of horrible. You know, the easiest part of Christianity, I feel like, to prove is that the world is kind of messed up. Like, we have all the pieces for everything to work well. We've been provided with everything we need. And we've done a really good job of messing it all up and hurting one another because of our fears and our insecurities. So I think when there are these moments where you're like, oh, this is so painful, or this is so awful, and I really hate white people in this moment. For me, I'm like, yeah, like my whole education is like, let's learn all the ways. And so I think for me in those moments, when we have those conversations, that's normal for me of like, what are the ways in which the world can live together or our family can live together that allow people to be who God made them to be? Mm-hmm. That's like par for the course.
Yeah. And we talk a lot about systems. And I think that's like sort of the shorthand. I'm not talking about individual white people. I'm surrounded by white people. I adore white people. I'm talking about white systems of oppression and of privilege. And when we are talking to the various intersecting systems within each of us. And so I'm talking to a white, queer male Christian pastor who is my husband, and he is talking to a Black queer male writer who is his husband. And I think the thing that is hardest for us is when one of those identities comes to the forefront in a way that's either aggressive or vulnerable, and that can happen for either one of us. And that's frustrating because the world seems less complex than it actually is. I think the embracing of complexity is the thing that allows us to be together. I was at The Moth, the storytelling show I host, the other night, and I was talking about this moment from our wedding where we had this cabaret reception, and we had this woman in the band who sounds just like Whitney Houston. And the minute I heard her, I was like, oh, she needs to sing at our wedding. You know, one, because the preacher's wife, and two, because who doesn't love Whitney Houston? So she starts off singing, I think she started off singing I Believe in You and Me from The Preacher's Wife. And people were like, this is great. Like people were like talking, chatting, and then they all just sort of shut up. They're like, what's happening? And then she merged into I Will Always Love You. And my mother shoots out of her seat, and people all over the church are like screaming because it's like astounding. It's this magical moment. And then she goes into I Want to Dance with Somebody. And the dance floor, I'm getting chills just thinking about it. The dance floor floods with people. And I remember looking around, and there were a couple of white women that I went to high school with, and my brothers dancing with their wives and our friends now. And I remember looking at the dance floor, and there were same-sex couples and couples where one member or both members were gender nonconforming or trans, and heterosexual couples. There were couples of the same race. There were couples of different races. There was no clear majority. There was my parents in their 60s. And then there was my nephew, who's Black and white, and will grow up knowing that this is the world. This is normal. This is the whole story. There are times that I feel like the world is terrible. And then I think back to Whitney Houston at our wedding. And I'm like, oh, no, this is a good story. That makes me really happy.
And for me, that moment, the wedding and all of us being together and that celebration of love and what we were doing there, to me, that's like a foretaste of what the world should be. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's like literally heaven on earth in that moment. And I'm like, this is God's dream for the world. Mm-hmm. And the dream for my life that I didn't think was possible. And yet here we are. Mm-hmm. And the last song of our wedding ceremony was I See a World, this beautiful gospel song about like, I see this world. And we literally had this moment where everyone got to see that world and be a part of it. And one of my favorite memories in life.
Me too.
We'd like to thank David and Eric for sharing their story with us.
You can find The Loving Project in iTunes and just about anywhere else that podcasts are available. And if you like the show, please consider leaving a review.
You can also find out more about The Loving Project at our website, lovingproject.com, where you'll also find pictures of some of the couples profiled on the show and ways to follow us on social media. I'm Farrah Parks.
And I'm Brad Linder. Thanks for listening to The Loving Project.
In the next episode of The Loving Project, we'll hear from Cord and Leslie.
Cord is Black and grew up in the Philadelphia area. Leslie is white and was raised in North Carolina. But when she celebrated New Year's Eve with Cord's family for the first time, Leslie and Cord realized they shared some unexpected traditions.
My mother had prepared black-eyed peas for luck and collard greens for money, which have to be the first things you eat in the new year, in the hopes that you will have those things in the year.
And of course, Cord didn't really know any white people in New Jersey who did that.
No, and white people in Philly and Jersey don't do
it. I didn't really think of it as a Black thing. I thought of it as a Southern thing. But of course, Black and Southern are often the same. But that kind of thing makes you realize just how weird it is that white and Black Southerners don't talk to each other more because they're doing a lot of the same kind of cultural things.
Leslie and Cord's story, coming up next time on the Loving Project podcast.